You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2214 South Broad Street. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
We're thinking about postures of Jesus followers. Like, what do Jesus followers look like? How do they live? And last week we started with a posture of being still. I've been noticing in the Bible how God calls us to be even before we do. A lot of times they go together at the same time. But Jesus called his disciples to be with him first, hang out. They hung out with him for a long time and they started to soak up this love in relationship. And then they were sent out to preach the good news and to cast out demons and all these big things. But they started out with being. So I think that's a good place to start. Tonight, the story kind of intensifies when Jesus is with his disciples on the weekend that he's going to be killed. I think he exposes another posture for us, another posture of a Jesus follower. Many of you have heard this story, but I just want to read it again. From the book of John. It's a cool moment. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. So he's going to demonstrate something that he wants his disciples to hang on to. The evening meal was being served. The devil had already prompted Judas to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. And so he got up from the meal and took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Peter, who said to him, "Lord, you're going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You don't realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you will never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," he replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you, for he knew who was going to betray him." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you for you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." So I think we need to understand a little bit more about the culture here to get the kind of radical thing that Jesus was doing. I mean, it's already kind of awkward for us modern people to think about washing feet. But learning more about the Hebrew culture kind of helped me to understand how awkward it was for these guys to have God serve them. The roads around that everybody walked around were full of dirt, and they were dirt. And I think it's hard, you know, we sanitize everything. So it's kind of hard for us to even understand, like, just the daily dirt and you know what, you know, without plumbing that people lived with and came in contact with all the time and with animals all around and stuff. And so it was customary and expected that if you went to somebody's house or had them before any meal or before a fancy meal like this, there would be a slave at the door with a water pot and they would remove your sandals. You'd sit down, they would remove your sandals for you and wash your dirty feet. Washing the feet of travelers would have been a job that was delegated to a Gentile slave by the host. Not even a Jewish slave would be expected to wash feet. And the host of a meal would certainly not lower himself to performing this vile task. You know, and Jesus is like seriously being the host of this meal because he's saying, this is my body broken for you. I mean, I'm literally serving. I'm the food too at this meal. And according to some of the rabbinical texts, this is the one thing that a rabbi was forbidden to do, was to ever take the dirty sandals off of somebody's feet and wash feet, because it was just so ceremonially unclean. They had, I mean, everybody had to go through like washing ceremonies all the time, but rabbis especially needed to be ceremonially clean, and so they would never do something like this. It was the worst thing. And so here in this moment, Jesus is shocking them. It's kind of funny, like right before this moment, the disciples are having this dispute. This is just such a key moment, because Jesus knows he's about to die, and he wants to really show his love to his disciples, give them some instructions. What they do is have a fight about who is greater before this whole scene. They're having a dispute about which of them is considered to be the greatest. This is just amazing. I mean, Donald Trump is having this dispute every day, but the disciples, you know, they've lived with Jesus for like 3 years, and they're in this moment of such importance, they're talking about which one of them is greater. Maybe like who'd given up the most to follow Jesus, who was the most devoted, you know, who was the smartest. I don't even know. But what the conversation did was it tore them apart. In this moment where Jesus is so focused on fulfilling the will of his Father, he's dealing with this competing mentality about who's right, who's better, who is the greatest. They still didn't get that to be a disciple of Jesus meant to be an imitator of Jesus. And I think at this point it would have been easy for Jesus to say, listen, guys, I'm the Son of God. It doesn't really matter who you think is the greatest, because you're all the same beneath me. I'm greater than all of you. But he didn't say that. You know, in this moment, I think where he would have had, if rights are a thing, you know, he would have had a right to be puffed up with ego, knowing that his moment of sacrifice and rescue were coming. But instead, he walks over to the door and he gets this basin of water and he begins to take off their dirty sandals, humiliate himself in front of them. And I kind of imagine that all the pride in the room kind of drains out. All the competitiveness, the arrogance, and the desires to be great kind of slip away as these guys watch God rub the dirt off their feet. I imagine the water probably gets muddier each time. Jesus, you know, continuing to reach in to the you-know-what water and let it flow over their feet. I can imagine the awkwardness of that. And then Jesus, you know, maybe Jesus gets to an especially dirty foot, and it's Peter, and he looks up into Peter's eyes, and Peter says, this cannot happen. Peter's always the one to kind of speak out. It makes me think of this one time that I was working at the office at 1125 South Broad, and somebody came up the steps. I think they were detoxing, maybe, and they threw up. They barfed all down the steps of 1125. And so I cleaned it up. You know, nobody's there. Matt, you remember this? Well, one of my friends got so mad at me for doing that. They said, why didn't you call somebody? You can't be doing that. They were just so upset about it. I think that's how Peter felt. I am nothing compared to Jesus, but I imagine that's how Peter felt in this moment of being served by Jesus. It was just so out of the question for him. And so then Jesus answers a little more directly, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. And I think we probably could spend a whole night on just unpacking that statement that Jesus makes there. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Unless we get vulnerable and allow God to serve us, I think we're really not having this relationship. If you're not asking God for help, like all the time, I'm not sure what you're doing. Because Jesus goes on to describe how this is the foundation for all relationships. He says, "Do you understand what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for this is who I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done." And a couple minutes later, Jesus is even more direct. He says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, you must love one another." We've kind of built our whole church around that demonstration by God to us, receiving that kind of love. I think Jesus, through this unexpected and embarrassing glimpse of influence being turned into servanthood, the church is told how it's supposed to relate to one another. And I saw that yesterday in the way our congregation hosted once a quarter, we have a big feast where we're five congregations now as our cells keep growing. And we get together every 3 months and usually eat together, and we gather around the communion meal. I wasn't sure how it was going to go here because this is kind of a smaller space. We've never hosted, 200 plus people in this building. And there's kids, there's lots of kids in the mix, and we're trying to put food tables all over the lobby. And I wasn't sure how it was going to go, but as I was setting up with the crew, I was like, wow, I just kind of noted to myself how much fun I was having, because there were so many people in the mix that were helping. And that's just one little glimpse of who we are, but that spirit of teamwork and service said to me, okay, we're doing something. We're learning to love like Jesus. We are serving one another. So I think there are lots of things that can kind of hinder this spirit of service in a community, this posture of serving. Obviously, selfishness, which, man, we're just wired that way. So we battle that all the time. I think also a fear of looking weak, fear of asking for help or being vulnerable, needing your feet to be washed. And then judgmentalism, how quickly we decide if somebody is in or out. People have actually said to me, "I don't know if this person would be Circle of Hope." I'm like, what does that mean? What does that mean? Are we deciding that people are out before they even get a chance to be in? One more story from the Bible that I want to show you real quick. Probably trying to pack too much into one little talk, but it's a good one, I think, where Jesus kind of looks at this. Jesus kind of questions this spirit of judgmentalism that can hinder inclusion and servanthood in a community. Can somebody who has good eyes read this for us? It's kind of tiny. Thank you, Frankie.
"On one of these, the expert in the law put up that he's a teacher. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Where is written in the law, he replied. How do you read it? The answer: love your Lord God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus. Do this, and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he answered, 'And who is my neighbor?' He replied to him and said, 'A man who fell down from Greece and Jericho, and was attacked by robbers. The stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him for dead. Three times he was going down the same road, and he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. A Samaritan of the traveler came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have.' Which of these three do you think were the neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" The expert in law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise."
Yes, thank you. So the hero of this story is the guy who is the enemy. The Samaritan people were considered enemies of the Jewish people. They were kind of living among them after the Assyrians came and dominated half the country, and they, you know, they worshiped idols, and so the Hebrew people like hated them, thought of them as enemies, and thought of themselves as like spiritually holier than them too. So Jesus is really challenging their sense of righteousness by giving a story where the example of the neighborly, generous person, the person who loves God, is the Samaritan. And I think a couple of things are really interesting to me. The expert in the law can't even say who the guy's name, like can't even say Samaritan. He says the one who had mercy on him. I think it's just so hard to swallow this kind of enemy love. Another thing that jumps out at me is how the guy kind of wanted to justify himself, and Jesus calls that out. The man is concerned with defining the neighbor. That's really his whole question. He wants this like identity category, which I think our culture is just fraught with these categories, and people, you know, we get so stuck in like figuring out what kind of person we are. Maybe like some of those personality tests, I think they're fun too. But you know, whatever we're interested in, whatever our preferences are, the kind of stuff we buy, the algorithms of Google and Facebook will tailor what they send to us based on those preferences, political too. And so it's so easy to get stuck in these categories. And Jesus is trying to push back against the categories, and he notices that the guy is just trying to define the neighbor. While Jesus is concerned with defining the love, Jesus cares less about helping us define who our neighbor is, I think. He cares more about helping us be the kind of people that someone else would identify as a good neighbor. We want to know who. Jesus seems more concerned with how love looks. We want to define and narrow when it comes to neighbors, and God wants to unleash and expand. And I think the reality is, because with Jesus, no one is an outsider, even though they might even categorize themselves as one. And we're so trained to respect people's separate identities, and I wonder if that actually keeps people apart. Love is about being safe enough to move through conflict with each other. And we work on that as a circle of hope, because we know it's not easy to speak the truth in love, to love each other through conflict. But Jesus empowers us to do it, even to love people that we might think of as enemies. And I think where Jesus is always going is seeing people's humanity, seeing them as they really are, the needy and wonderful person that they really are, in spite of whatever case that we've built against them in our heads. You know, when you have a fight with somebody, you don't talk to them for a while, they can seem worse and worse and worse in your mind because you build this whole kind of thing against them. I think Jesus is calling us to get face to face to help break that down. One of my friends showed me this Jimmy Fallon clip and it's from a long time ago, so maybe you already saw it. But he did this experiment where after Robinson Cano got traded from the Yankees to the Seattle Mariners, he was coming back for the first time to New York City to play. And of course, the New Yorkers wanted to boo him. And so Jimmy Fallon kind of gets them face to face. What? Of course they would. But Jimmy Fallon does this experiment where he's going to bring them face to face with the guy that they're trying to hate on. So check it out.
Tomorrow night, Robinson Cano, the former New York Yankee All-Star second baseman, returns to Yankee Stadium for the first time since he left for a 10-year, $240 million contract with the Seattle Mariners. Now, obviously, Cano's going to hear a fair share of boos when he steps up to the plate tomorrow, and that could be jarring for any player. So that's why, to get him used to it, we sent Robinson Cano out to the streets of New York to get booed by actual Yankee fans. But here's the catch. The fans thought they were just booing a cardboard cutout of Robinson Cano. They didn't realize that the real Robinson Cano was standing right behind it. Their reactions are pretty great. Check it out.
Hi, I'm Robinson Cano, and I'm about to get booed by some Yankees fan.
Are you a Yankee fan?
Yes.
Now, Robinson Cano is coming back to Yankee Stadium tomorrow night for the first time since becoming a Seattle Mariner. Are you going to boo him?
Of course.
All right, well, we have this picture of him right behind you, so whenever you're ready, go ahead and boo it as much as you want.
Boo! You know what? You no longer welcome here. Bye.
Try again.
You no longer... How you doing?
Now, Robinson Cano is coming back to Yankee Stadium tomorrow night for the first time since becoming a Seattle Mariner. Are you going to boo him?
I'm going to boo the out of him. All right.
Well, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
All right.
Give him your best boo.
Boo! You suck!
That was awesome. Maybe try it again.
Should I try it again?
Yeah.
How you doing, Robbie? Welcome back to New York.
Thank you.
Be back, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
No problem, man.
Are you going to boo him?
You know, he won a World Series ring here, but he did leave for the money, so...
Why don't you go ahead and give him as many boos as you want?
Come on, Robinson. I mean, how many World Series titles do the Mariners have? Come on, boo! You're better than that. You got a beard now? You're better than that. Boo!
Ooh.
Robinson,
how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Thanks for the boo.
Either way.
Welcome back to New York.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready, go ahead and boo!
Boo! You should go home, boo!
Try booing him one more time.
Oh.
I'm sorry, man. Are you going to boo him?
Yes, I am. Boo!
All right, well, we actually have this picture of him right behind you, so whenever you're ready, go ahead, boo him as much as you want.
Boo, Robinson, you should have stayed here. Winners is in New York, not in Seattle.
Try booing him one more time.
Boo! Stay in Seattle. We don't need you in New York. Hey! How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Good.
Go ahead, boo him as much as you want.
Boo! Boo!
Whoa!
How you doing? Thanks for the boo.
Yeah, no problem. I won't boo you. I won't boo you. I won't actually boo you. I'll be rooting for you to play well, but not win.
Are you gonna boo him?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, whenever you're ready, go ahead and boo him for as long as you want.
Right here.
Yep.
Boo! 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 Come on, everybody! Boo!
Actually, try one more.
One more?
Yeah.
Oh,
how you doing?
Listen, about that, right? Again. Here's what happened.
So, it's easy to think of people as one or two dimensional. When we think we have something against them, it's awful to be on the receiving end of that anger, right? I mean, Robinson was really gracious about it there and kept extending the hand, but it's really actually not that easy. And I think we need to keep hearing from Jesus about seeing each other as full humans. I want to close with this story about a fellow pastor in Kansas, a Brethren in Christ pastor. Friend of mine, he has 5 kids, and he and a church, and he also leads the Kansas Foster and Adoptive Parent Association. A few years ago, they took in 2 kids. Mom was on drugs and wanted to have visitation rights. They said yes, and she visited about once a week. But at some point, she was still abusing heroin, and she wanted to have the kids back, and so she accused my friend Jeff of sexually abusing the 2 girls. And Jeff and his family spent the next couple months being dragged through the mud and brought before the court, and it of course affected his church, and people wondered if he really did it. The kids, the 2 foster kids, were taken away from them. But in the midst of this, Jeff and his wife continued to maintain contact with this mom, even though they knew she was going through it. They refused to give up on her. One day, several months later, she called him up. She had just gotten out of jail, and she said, I don't have anybody. I need a place to stay. And they said, you can move in with us. And I just think that is like the agape love of God, this self-giving love that Jesus has for us. This is the heart of a servant, the posture of putting somebody else's interests above your own. It's not easy to discern. I'm not saying we should always do this, because it's not easy to discern really sometimes. But this is the love that God has for us. And I think it has the power to change the world. This lady now has one more reason to explore Jesus in light of all the evidence that people that she might have found against Christians or against being loved before. So the world around us tends to think that most people aren't worth your time. And we say differently. They say when somebody wrongs you, the heck with them. We say that this is a chance for the Spirit to shine through. To be called by Jesus is to learn the posture of kneeling. I think it's a heart of service and neighbor and enemy love.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.